Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Being hit in the dark of night by a rapidly rising flood that's being fed by a downpour that doesn't seem to quit is more than enough of a shock. But then the loss of lives and the destruction discovered after sunrise can really mess with your mind. It piles an invisible toll on top of the physical exhaustion. Logan Burris is familiar with what I just described. Clinic coordinator at the EKU Psychology Clinic, Logan is a Letcher County native, and he's been making the trek between Richmond and his hometown of Partridge, about a 15-minute drive from the Kentucky-Virginia state line, pitching in to help out. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Logan.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And so home is Partridge, Kentucky. As I understand it, that's about 3 hours one way from Richmond. Is that correct?
I'd say so. It's about 2.5 hours with some light traffic.
Okay. And you've been back since the flood?
Yes, I have.
Tell us what you found.
Well, when I found out about the flood on Thursday morning, the first thing that I did was I contacted my dad because I know that we live next to a river. I wanted to check in on them and their safety. And we were blessed because all my family were safe. However, he did show me a picture. He actually is the manager of a pharmacy in Isom, Kentucky, and it was under 3 to 4 feet of water.
Oh, boy.
So what I did was I had left that day, and I came down there as the water began to recede, and I spent the next 3 days helping out with his pharmacy crew to clean out the damage.
Was pretty much the town underwater?
I think that there was very large areas of high-rising water in most places. Mm-hmm. Whitesburg, the ones that I'm familiar with, was Whitesburg and Isom. There was a grocery store, the IGA, which is right next to the pharmacy, and they got the same amount of water. There was a lot of damage.
Well, Logan, as one who works in a mental health clinic, I imagine you're especially attuned to signs of mental fatigue, exhaustion, even despair that we hear about. Have you seen these things among people who've survived the flood?
I have seen some of that. I think that physical and mental health go hand in hand at times. I believe that adequate amount of sleep, eating right, and healthy exercise, that's very important for mental health. However, with all of the stress and everything that's happening, it can take a toll on the mind and the psyche as well.
It seems like a perfect storm, if you will. It sure can be that when you have the actual event itself, you have the exhaustion that comes from trying to just survive it, and then you turn around and you got to clean it up, and there's no certainty about the future. There are a lot of reasons there to be very upset, to put it mildly. What do you think are some of the most common issues among flood survivors?
Well, I would say, you know, there is a large shock that starts. I think that shock and a sort of numbness begins, kind of unbelievability. I mean, most people, they lost everything that they've ever had. And it's a lot different, you know. You live your whole life thinking, you know, that this is how things go. And you have sort of a routine, but then one day you wake up and everything is gone. I can imagine that it's very traumatic, very stressful, and can cause a lot of mental health issues down the road.
Well, what can people do to get some help, some relief from that kind of stress right now?
Well, you know, I think the beauty of that area, the beauty of my hometown and that I take great pride in, is that the community is really banded together. You know, I look over and I see people, whether they be from church groups or just neighbors, they're going out to help their fellow friend. And I know that many other people across the state of Kentucky are also helping. So I think that you need that sense of support, that sense of community is there at first. But looking forward on a more personal note, I think that it's important to make yourself known of some resources that might be available for your mental health and to process that kind of trauma and grief that happens.
Well, since we're talking about resources, the EKU clinic would be one. It's been relocating and returning to in-person services slowly after closing during COVID. What services does the clinic offer?
The clinic offers many services. We offer therapy and assessment services, meaning for assessment. We do evaluations for ADHD, specific learning disabilities, and autism spectrum disorder. But for therapy, we actually have a specialty clinic, the Trauma and Suicide Prevention Clinic, and that is headed by one of our other coordinators, Shelby Meadows. And we work very strongly with that, processing trauma and grief, and working with the prevention of suicide.
If people in the flooded area are feeling these things, are sensing that something's wrong, and they just really are at the point where they need help, is the clinic at EKU open to them, open to the public?
Yes. As we are moving in person, like you said, we are also keeping our telehealth open, mm-hmm. and these are to build the bridges to the rural communities of Kentucky. The only caveat that we have is that you must be in Kentucky when we see you because of the laws there. However, we are available for new clients. Our phone number is actually 859-622-2356. And you just call. If no one answers, that's okay. Just leave a message with your name and the things that you want to work on, and we'll get back to you. I also want to mention, if anyone, you know, during these times of trauma and grief, it can be very disheartening. And if anyone would think about hurting themselves or thinking about suicide, I suggest that, first of all, the suicide hotline number in the nation has changed to a 3-digit number now. That has changed to 988. But also, I think that telling someone is important as well. Telling someone and making sure that they know.
All right. That's Logan Burris, coordinator at the EKU Psychology Clinic, also a native of Letcher County, Kentucky. Thank you so much, Logan.
Thank you, Tom.
Sam Adams reports in the Mountain Eagle that the flood wiped out most of Letcher County's farmers. Sam tells us that the majority of available farmland in the county is in bottomland beside creeks and rivers, and of course, that was inundated by the water, ruined crops, and swept away livestock. In fact, in the west end of the county, cattle were washed away in the flood and fencing was wiped out, so cattle that didn't drown got away into the mountains. The Letcher County Farmers Market is participating, along with markets in Breathitt, Knott, and Perry counties. There's a flyer on our homepage, esweku.org, with all the locations, dates, and times. You sometimes hear about parachute journalists, reporters assigned to cover a crisis. They come get what they need, and then they move on to the next assignment. They're doing their jobs. We need them to get the word out to the world about what's happening here. But some come and stay. Alan Maiman had been a foreign correspondent for the New York Times when he was hired by the Courier-Journal to become the paper's Eastern Kentucky bureau chief, based in Hazard. Not only did Maiman set up shop in Hazard, he ended up getting married to the daughter of a Harlan County coal miner, and last summer he published Twilight in Hazard, an Appalachian reckoning. It was based on his 5 years of getting to know the area in ways that most of us don't bother to. The book did cause a stir, so much so that Alan Maiman returned to Hazard to listen to those reactions. He has since written an afterword about the experience, and it appears in the paperback version of the book. Alan, reading from the first paragraph of the new afterword included in the paperback edition, you say that Appalachian Kentuckians are understandably sensitive about outsiders writing about their home. Perhaps now, in the aftermath of the worst flash flooding anybody can recall, that's true more than ever. Now, you've been keeping in touch with family and contacts since the flooding. What are you hearing?
Well, yes, fortunately, my wife's family in Harlan County was spared from the devastation of the floods that hit almost everywhere else in the area. But yeah, let's start by just talking about how horrible and tragic and heartbreaking this is, and the devastation and the loss of life are just unimaginable. And so the people that I've been talking to down there, many of whom are involved in relief efforts are painting a very vivid picture for me of that devastation. And one thing I'll say is that a person that I'll talk to one day who is trying to clean up their own mess is the next day going out and helping other people.
That's a really prevailing trait among the people of the mountain region of Kentucky, is that they do look after each other. I know that you came back after the hardcover edition of Twilight in Hazard was published, got a lot of praise in the first year of release, also some pushback from some who felt that it lacked qualities of hope and redemption and spoke too little about community-level efforts to bring about change. So you responded by returning to the area to listen. And some in the audience argued that Hazard is actually experiencing the dawn of a new day, not, as the title implies, the sun setting on a previous one. However, this event has now occurred. In your assessment of things, have we been set back?
I think this obviously has to be viewed as a major setback, and how long of a setback it is remains to be seen. But as for the pushback I received on the book after it was first released, honestly, I would have been surprised and a little bit disappointed if there hadn't been some questions asked about a book that poses some very serious questions about the challenges facing the region and some of the systems and structures in the region that I feel have made it difficult for the area to create the brighter future that so many people have been talking about recently and putting some very hard work into achieving. But of course, when you have something like this happen, there's going to be a period of adversity and setback, and one can only hope that out of this will come an even stronger, renewed sense of purpose and determination in terms of broadening the economy and making Eastern Kentucky's future brighter.
What do you think about economic development under these circumstances? Can the momentum that we were beginning to enjoy prior to this event, can that be recaptured under these circumstances?
I think the response to this tragic event provides, in some ways, an inspiring framework for what can happen after the cleanup is complete. If you look at the way in which individuals and businesses and nonprofits and religious organizations have all come together and rallied together to take a tragic situation and just try to help people, many people in need, I think that provides a template in some ways to how local communities can function post tragic circumstances in terms of building their economy, coming together in the same way.
Well, eventually we're going to get back to that. And you do state in your afterword that another year of observing Eastern Kentucky has further convinced you that there's value in a jigsaw approach to economic development, an approach that's more gradual and won't make headlines, maybe not for a while, but eventually could produce something of value. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, I've long said that I believe that going forward and in the longer term, that the patchwork that I view is it's not a swing for the fences project that will employ thousands of people and with aspirations of bringing in thousands more tourists, but rather an approach that focuses on a number of different industries: tech, agriculture, tourism, the arts, et cetera. And we've seen bits of that already. And we've also seen some promising downtown revitalization efforts. So that's the patchwork that I'm speaking of. And I think that, unfortunately, in the wake of this tragic event, that there's even more, I think there's even more going in favor of taking that approach.
There's a discussion of big increases in infrastructure, in combating the physics of the region somehow. An example that has been cited has been the Pikeville cut-through, which, of course, was a feat of engineering on a par with the Panama Canal. So incredibly expensive. And, of course, that can't be applied everywhere all over the region. But in your discussions with folks in the region and others, is infrastructure the answer?
I think infrastructure is certainly a big part of the answer. 3 weeks ago, we kind of looked at the phrase "build back better" as just a phrase and just a name given to a piece of ambitious legislation. But I think the words "build back better" resonate now very strongly in Eastern Kentucky because the need is obviously great for that to happen. So yeah, I think infrastructure is a key part of this. It's all interconnected. We're talking improving the social safety net at the same time. We're talking about roads. We're talking about bridges. We're definitely talking about digital infrastructure. This is certainly a wake up call, I think, in terms of the importance of physical infrastructure as being a key component to a more prosperous future.
So in your discussions with folks in the region, with family and friends in the region, do you have hope that perhaps this terrible, terrible event and tragedy and the loss of life and property could someday yield those enormous changes that have to take place to prevent this from happening again?
I think this hopefully could be a turning point in a number of different ways in terms of recognizing some of the systemic forces at play here that may have made the catastrophic flooding that much more catastrophic, and simply coming together, rallying together, and trying to execute some of the plans that have been in place now for a little bit in terms of bolstering the economy, broadening the economic base. That's all you can hope for, that out of tragedy comes something inspiring and comes something better. Maybe a little bit of time before that's experienced, but I think there are some signs already that down the road, this could be a turning point in some positive ways for the region.
Is the paperback edition of Twilight and Hazard now available? Is it on the market?
It is. It's available at, I'm always a proponent of supporting local stores. So Reed Spotted Newt in Hazard is one place people can get it. Joseph Beth in Lexington, Carmichael's in Louisville, as well as on the Penguin Random House website, should be pretty easy to get. And I think that, especially in light of these recent events, it's worth a read.
That's Alan Maiman, the former New York Times foreign correspondent who became the Courier-Journal's Eastern Kentucky Bureau chief, lived in the community and even married into it, on an update to his book, Twilight in Hazard. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You can meet Alan Maiman. He'll be signing his book at the 41st Annual Kentucky Book Festival at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Lexington on Saturday, October 29th. Coming up after the break, details of an upcoming event commemorating the legacy of local African American athletes.
We want to honor them, award them. We want people to meet them. And so we decided to pull out all the stops.
Research into the joys of being thought of.
Maybe people are underestimating how much others actually appreciate being reached out to.
And the benefits of discovering cultures through music.
One of the things that drives us is the realization that no matter where you are, people are more alike than different.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker. Provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald Houses in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More information at www.togetherwesaveky.com. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
On September the 24th, the Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame inaugural induction ceremony and gala will be happening in downtown Lexington. The co-founders of this initiative want to honor Lexington athletes, coaches, officials, and supporters who are deserving of recognition for their contributions to Lexington sports culture. The creators of this event at Central Bank Center are retired Fayette County teachers Bobby and Jennifer Jones, and they're Gerald Smith's latest guests in our series on racial justice and equality in America.
Mr. Jones, discuss the founding of the Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame.
There are a lot of people in Lexington who, in our opinion, are deserving of some kind of recognition for what they've given in terms of their sports accolades, et cetera. And so out of the blue, I just said, Jennifer, let's start our own Hall of Fame. Let's start our own Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame. It just came out as simple as that. And of course, it's a mouthful. And we just oftentimes we just use the acronym LASHOF, LAASHOF. So that's how it started, with basically nothing more than just an idea.
Considering the fact that there are other sports Hall of Fames in Kentucky, how do you think this is going to be even more significant or just as equally significant as those other sports Hall of Fames in the state?
And I think folks are aware, not only regionally and statewide, but nationally, that Kentucky really does have a rich sports history. We're not talking just about the Kentucky Derby and the University of Kentucky basketball. But if you grew up here, you know about the sports history, the sports legacy. And so we think that what we're doing, Dr. Smith, is addressing something here locally. There are a lot of people who are actually bitter, and they have stories to tell, stories of feeling used and forgotten about. And then for most of them, particularly the elderly, when we actually talk to them and ask if they would, if they would accept selection, they would say things like, "I didn't think anybody even cared," or "I thought we were forgotten about," and that oftentimes would result in tears, et cetera. And so, after experiencing a few of those kinds of scenarios, we realized that wow, there is a need for this. Our elderly, the ones that actually paved the way for us, they're the ones who are responsible for our being where we're at now. So I think it's just important that we pay homage to them, that we honor and award them, and not only that, but we preserve their legacies.
I want to ask Ms. Jones, so just very succinctly, what is your mission?
Okay, our mission is really threefold. Primarily, we want to provide supplemental scholarships to local student athletes who earned a partial sports scholarship to a university or a college. But we know how it is. Sometimes you need extra funds for a meal plan or for book purchases or other supplies. We've had children to go through that. We've been blessed to be able to help them, but not every family is able to do that. So our primary goal is to provide supplemental scholarships to local students who have received a partial sports scholarship but could use additional funds just to get them through that first year, because we all know how that can be. And we know that food insecurity on college campuses is real. So if we can, provide a few meals for a couple of kids that help keep them in school, maybe take a burden off their family, we're more than happy to do that. So that's our primary goal. Our second mission is to plan and host an annual Sports Hall of Fame Awards ceremony and banquet, which we're doing this fall, September 24th at the Central Bank Center, where we are inducting 22 individuals and two teams from the segregated and the early post-segregated era, where we want to make this a black tie affair. We're going to honor them, and we'll talk more about the gala later on, but where they'll actually be inducted into our inaugural Hall of Fame. And then the third mission, which Bobby was alluding to, is we really want our own standalone building where we can house this memorabilia. As Bobby said, our seniors are leaving us, and all those memories, the uniforms, the trophies, the nets they cut down, all those things are just languishing in boxes and basements, around the city. Well, we want to get a hold of those things and preserve them, because our kids have no idea what their legacy is and what has been done before them. So those are the three prongs to our mission.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this inaugural class of inductees. How were they selected? In other words, what was the criteria? And then also, if you could share some of the persons that will be inducted in this class.
Be glad to do that. We had more than 200 names submitted, both from the public and from within our founding members group. And we had some criteria that we wanted to go by. We've got some stellar athletes. We have Olympians. We have World Series champions. We have NBA titleists, we have NCAA finalists. Well, you know, we've had the gamut here in Lexington, but we also have those that were, you know, crowd favorites and who just really brought joy to people in our city back in the day, or they were the playground heroes. So we had those types of things that we wanted to include. You know, did they make it to the professional ranks? Did they win any particular types of awards? Were they All-American? Were they All-City, All-State? Just various things. And then the impact of for coaches, you know, were they award-winning? What impact did they have on their players, on their teams? If they were officials, you know, were they well-known? Were they history-making, as in the case for the one that we did choose this year? And then for our supporters, just the time and the effort and the heart that they put into the youth of our city and how they've dedicated their lives to make everything better for the kids around them. And then as far as some of the people, these are... We call them Lexington sports royalty. I mean, we have Coach S.T. Roach, who, you know, you look up Coach in the dictionary, and his picture's there. Just the class and the dignity that he brought to the sport, you know, during difficult times of segregation, bridging that gap between segregation and integration and requiring so much of his players, you know, how to handle themselves and how to conduct themselves despite what was going on around them. Household name. Charlie Givens, another mainstay at the Salvation Army, impacted so many children and their futures by, you know, helping them get into school, making connections for them, you know, coaching as well, and that award-winning coach. Donna Robinson Wilson has won multiple national championships and even a world championship from right here in Lexington with Henry Clay High School, and many people don't even know the accomplishments, you know, that she made. Our referee is Brenda Garner Hughes. She was the first African-American official referee the girls' state tournament, which I remember her calling my games. I mean, I had to see an African-American woman in uniform, in a position of authority and calling those games just spoke so much to me as a young teenager. So she was history making in that area, and also called the games at the Dirt Bowl and the state tournament. Just really blazed a new trail. Some of the athletes we have, Tyson Gay. I have Tyson Gay's phone number in my phone. It's just the weirdest thing to me that I could pick up my phone and call him at any time. World record holder, Olympic medalist, just from right here in Lexington. We also have DeMonte Dawson, you know, All-Pro, NFL Hall of Fame. We have Mark Logan, multiple Super Bowl championships, John Shelby, multiple World Series championships, Dirk Minifield. We have Jack Givens and James Lee, NCAA championships. Tanya Fogle, one of the first African-American women to play at the University of Kentucky to play basketball and won the only SEC title that the UK women's team has ever won. And she was the captain of that team. So many others, and I can keep going. John Will Brown, you know, from back in the day, was a stellar athlete in multiple sports and did lots of parks and recreation. Steve Chandler, World Series winner, multiple state championships. Joe Hamilton, George Wilson, Bobby Washington. You know, they were back in the segregated and early post-segregated era. And we had to reach back and pull them in as well. And then we also have an old Dunbar team from 1959, the original Dunbar, and then a 1956 original Douglas team that was national runner-up in the National Negro High School basketball tournament because they weren't allowed to play in the KHSAA tournaments at that time. So this was in 56, just on the cusp of desegregation in Fayette County. So we've got some stellar quality athletes, but quality people that are making up this first class.
And Jennifer, you named almost all of them except a few of them, and I don't want to leave them out, if it's okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course, we have Jackie French, who is an icon at the Parks and Recreation Dunbar Center. She has put her life into children. When Jen and I went over to ask her if she would accept our induction, she said, she looked at us and says, "I don't deserve something like that." And the question I asked her, "Well, how many lives do you think you've saved over the years?" And she just kind of shook her head and said, "Well, I get it." And then, of course, everybody knows who Bobby Phuket Washington is. Played here in Lexington, of course, and at Dunbar, and then went on to, I believe, Eastern Kentucky and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And so we have him. And, of course, the youngest of the class is that of Shelvin Mack. Shelvin, of course, we all know, played here at Bryan Station High School under Bobby Washington. And then, of course, went on to the college ranks at Butler and played in two national championship finals games. And he himself is made a name for himself, not only here, but overseas. So we have a plethora of folks from various generations. That is actually part of our criteria, was select folks who aren't with us from the segregated era and post-segregated era, but then bring it right on up to the modern days. And so we are really, really proud of this class. I mean, these are, like Jennifer said, the royalty of the sports icons in Lexington. So it's exciting to talk with these folks, to be associated with them, and then not only that, but to honor them with their just due.
I want to make sure that we get time in for the inaugural Hall of Fame induction ceremony and Black Tie Gala that's going to take place here on September the 24th here in Lexington at the new Central Bank Center in downtown. Can you just take a minute or so to talk about this big gala that's taking place?
If anyone's ever watched the award show on the television, the Emmys, the Oscars, the Grammys, or even the BET Awards, that's what we're going to try to mimic for this first class, especially because we want them to feel like they themselves are superstars. We want to honor them, award them. We want people to meet them. And so we decided to pull out all the stops. We're talking about limo delivery of these folks to the venue, step out of the limo onto a red carpet, and then, of course, getting inside for, pictures and mingling, cocktails. We have live entertainment, fine dining. It's an evening of entertainment. We're going to be giving away some really nice gifts. Our sponsors are incredibly generous. They provided some of the things that we're able to do for these folks. Much of what we're able to do comes from donations that have been given generously by folks here in Lexington and abroad. It is going to be a night to remember. Glitz and glam and tuxedos and gowns and martinis, et cetera. So that's what we're going for. And to date, we're on track.
All right. So how can tickets be purchased to attend this event?
We have tickets on sale on Eventbrite, and the site is officiallayshoff.eventbrite.com. Tickets are available by seat or by table, and the ticket sales are going very, very brisk, so you might want to jump in and get your tickets pretty soon. You can also go to our website at laashof.com, that's layshoff.com, and there's a link there to purchase your tickets as well. But if you just put in Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame in the Eventbrite site, it will pull up the link to purchase your tickets.
All right, then. So that's the Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame induction ceremony and Black Tie Gala that's slated for September the 24th at the new Central Bank Center in downtown Lexington. That's Bobby and Jennifer Jones, co-founders of the Lexington African American Sports Hall of Fame. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
There is new research suggesting that casually reaching out to people in our social circles means more to them and to us than we might realize. Peggy Liu, chair in marketing and an associate professor of business administration at the University of Pittsburgh, is the lead author of a new study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology that found people tend to underestimate how much friends like to hear from them. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Liu.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, what inspired this research?
Yeah, so we actually, my co-authors and I, started this project right in the middle of the pandemic. And we had this experience where we felt like we were losing touch with a lot of people in our lives. You know, before the pandemic, I think many of us have had experiences where we just naturally connect with others, whether it's picking up coffee on the way to work or running into someone by the water cooler. And with so many people moving to remote work and staying at home, we felt like we were losing out on those natural opportunities for social connection to arise. And so my co-authors and I thought, why might that be? And one idea that we had was that maybe people are underestimating how much others actually appreciate being reached out to. If you think about your own life, when someone has actually reached out to you, perhaps on those rare occasions where someone reaches out to you, you probably really appreciated it. And so our question is, why aren't people doing that more often? Why aren't people actually reaching out to others? And so we tackled that question from this perspective of trying to look at how much others actually appreciate it compared to how much you think they'll appreciate it.
How did you go about conducting the study?
Yeah, so we conducted a large number of studies. I think the final paper has around 13 studies. So I'll describe one of them. In one of the studies, what we did was we actually approached students on college campuses and we asked them to write a brief note to a classmate that they haven't been in contact with for a while. And so we then deliver those notes on behalf of them. And then we ask the recipients, how much did you appreciate being reached out to? And then we also ask the people who reached out, how much do you think the other person is going to appreciate it? And what we find is that people who reached out underestimated how much their recipients actually appreciated being reached out to.
And you found that if we have these brief interactions with a wide range of people in our circles of relatives and friends, that we enjoy some positive psychological outcomes. What kinds of positive outcomes?
Yeah, so in our research, we don't really look after the outcomes of feeling happy, grateful, appreciative. But there's been other research which finds that if you have more social contact with others, whether it be strangers, acquaintances, friends, that those people tend to report higher psychological well-being. But again, that wasn't what we focused on in this work.
You looked at a variety of reasons for reaching out, asking for a favor, offering a compliment, to express gratitude. Can you expand on that a little bit? Why did you break it down into those categories?
Yeah, so in our work, we actually let it be super broad. We let people reach out and say whatever they wanted. And most people reach out just simply to say hi and to check in on how others are doing. And we find this underestimation of appreciation. There's been some really cool prior research conducted by some other researchers where they've looked at gratitude expression and they've looked at compliments. And what they find is a similar thing, that if you express gratitude to others, others appreciate it more than you think. And then there's also other work showing that if you compliment someone, they appreciate it more than you think. So all of this work, I think, generally converges on this idea that people considering engaging in these social exchange acts often underestimate how much the recipients are going to appreciate it. One thing I've thought about is a common thread that ties together this work. And I think one common thread might be that as the recipient, you're just thinking about, wow, I feel really warm. I really feel really surprised and really positive about having received, whether it be a thank you note, a compliment, or simply a reach out to say hello. Whereas the person considering reaching out, I think, is considering, you know, potentially, is this going to be awkward? Are they going to wonder about why I've reached out right now? Are they going to be delving into the thank you note I've written? And so I think those types of issues lead people to be reluctant to reach out or express gratitude or compliment as much as they perhaps should.
What about those times when you've heard about a friend, an acquaintance, a family member who is in some sort of situation, they need help, and you want to offer help, but should you go into that realizing that sometimes that can backfire? Sometimes maybe they really don't want to be asked if they need help?
I think that's a great question, and I would say that's probably a nice direction for future work. In our work, we've really focused it on, hey, you've lost touch with someone, and now you're going to be considering, reaching out to them and saying hello. I think there's been actually some recent work that I was just reading, which found that offering social support can be appreciated more than you think. And I think the key there might be that you don't go in presuming they need it, but you're just saying hello and asking them to tell you if they need any social support.
Why might people mispredict how much a friend or acquaintance would appreciate them simply reaching out?
So in our work, what we find evidence for is this role of surprise. So it turns out that if you're expecting someone to reach out to you, then your level of appreciation is pretty similar to what the guessers, the predictors, actually expect. Whereas when it's a reach out kind of out of the blue, what we find is that surprise, this feeling of surprise that you experience really amplifies how positive you feel. And people considering reaching out don't really think about those feelings of surprise. So if we think outside of the context of reaching out, there's been some cool research which finds that if you find a small amount of money versus you expect to get that amount of money, that additional feeling of surprise really boosts how positive you feel compared to the expected state of things. And so we think a similar thing might be going on here, which is that the surprise of being reached out to helps amplify how positive you feel. And people considering reaching out aren't really focusing on those feelings of surprise.
From what you've learned from this work, do you recommend being proactive about reaching out to acquaintances?
I do. So it's funny that you ask about what I do personally. So before the pandemic, I found I had more natural social interactions. And during the pandemic, I felt like I maybe lost touch with a lot of people and I wasn't sure how to reconnect. And so when that happens, I actually try to think about these research findings. And what I try to do is I'd remind myself that if other people that I'm considering reaching out to, if they reached out to me, I would probably feel really great about it. And so I tell myself, there's no reason why they wouldn't similarly appreciate it if I were to reach out to them. And so that's usually enough for me to overcome my hesitation and actually reach out to the person I'm thinking about.
So after you finished the work and published the study, did you find yourself texting a lot?
I did. It's funny because some of my friends who I had lost touch with from college actually reached out to me when they saw the coverage of this work. And so they actually were the ones doing the initiating, but I've also prompted myself to do that as well. And my mom has actually done the same. So she's lost touch, of course, with a number of friends from her college days, and this work helped lead her to actually reach out to them.
Dr. Peggy Liu, Associate Professor of Business Administration at the University of Pittsburgh, lead author of a new study, The Surprise of Reaching Out, Appreciated More Than We Think. And you can find the report on our site at esweku.org. Thank you, Dr. Liu.
Thank you.
Lee Carroll can be found all around the Lexington music scene, leading all kinds of bands from See the Beat to the Lee Carroll Trio, Quartet, Quintet, etc. The Northside Sheiks, Exile, he played with, The Judds, Fly By Night. He was the founder of Tin Can Buddha. Lee and his partner and wife, Connie Milligan, operate Green Room Exchange, a Lexington-based nonprofit with a mission of bridging cultures through music. And we're not talking about trading MP3s or links to websites. We're talking about the real thing, live performance and studio recording right here in Lexington. Music like this. That's a selection from the Senegal Project, and this blend of Senegalese and American, make that Kentucky, music will be performed live in Lexington on Saturday night at the Downtown Arts Center, and we have questions. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lee.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great, great, great. And we'll get into the details of that performance in just a moment. But first, a little bit of background, beginning briefly with how you became attracted to the music of West Africa.
Well, I grew up on R&B in the 60s, and it became apparent early on that African rhythms were a big part of the music that I loved. You know, New Orleans R&B and American funk. And then later on, as I studied jazz, Miles Davis's Bitches Brew and Herbie Hancock and Weather Report. And then you have Chick Corea, Return to Forever, doing the sambas. Everybody's drawing from this African tradition. So that's really what started my interest in it.
Well, Senegal. Senegal is a country in West Africa, bordered by Mauritania in the north, Mali to the east, Guinea to the southeast, Guinea-Bissau to the mm-hmm. southwest. You and Connie have been there and also to Ghana, gotten to know people and their traditions and their ways. What have you learned from those experiences?
One of the things that drives us, Tom, is the realization that no matter where you are, people are more alike than different. You know, so we've been several times to Ghana and to Senegal, and we have been treated with such respect and such kindness, and people have taken such interest in what we've done. It's just been a great experience, plus opening our eyes. I think it's tough. If you don't travel, if you don't get out and see other people in their culture and in their day-to-day existence, you can't really appreciate how similar we all are. The same thing drives all of us.
And to make a very long story short, you and Connie have hosted those musicians in your home here in Lexington and have brought in people from the community to meet them. You've done a lot. So the term green room exchange really has a lot of meaning. This music, there's really something about it. And I think the kora plays a big role in the sound, and a virtuoso of the instrument will be performing with you. Tell us about the instrument and the artist.
Well, the kora is an African harp. And what it is, it's a large gourd with a big long neck and 21 strings, and you tune it to whatever key you're going to be playing in. The fellow who's going to be performing with us is an award-winning kora player and guitarist. He's from Mali, which is one of the countries surrounding common heritage, musical heritage to Senegal. Mm-hmm. Dili More Tunkara is his name. He resides in Toronto. He'll be coming down here this week. We'll be rehearsing with these folks. We've had trouble getting people out of Senegal and Mali because you can't get visas now. It's a 9-month wait before you can actually go in to meet somebody to apply for a visa. We've been lucky enough that there are some really fantastic West African musicians residing in Canada and the United States.
What do you hope to accomplish, and this is a big picture question, but what do you hope to accomplish through Green Room Exchange from these performances?
Well, part of it's selfish. I get to play with these great musicians from around the world. But, you know, there's a real interest in this. There's a general term, world music, which means mm-hmm. anything not from the United States, you know. If you go around the world, it's not just music, it's art, it's everything. People's inventiveness is incredible in every culture. It doesn't matter where you go. And there's fantastic music being made all over Africa and all over South America and all over Europe and all over Asia. We're just trying to introduce folks in Lexington to some of these styles of music and some of these artists, and to give the artists a boost, you know, to help them out.
The show coming up on Saturday, there's a lot of buzz about it. I've been kind of out and about and heard from other people that are really excited about it and going to be there. Is it sold out, or are there tickets available?
It's not sold out, but, you know, we've sold out all our shows at the Black Box. It only holds a little over 200 people. So I would suggest you go ahead and get tickets. If you're interested, you want to get them online, you can go to lexingtonky.gov/black-box-theater, spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E, or call the box office at 859-425-2550. And go ahead and buy your tickets. If you wait to the day of the show, I'm afraid you're going to be out of luck.
And I guess if you go to, you all have a Facebook page.
So yes,
you get that information there too.
Well, yeah, we also have a website, greenroomexchange.org, and on our Facebook page. That would be another way to get your tickets.
Okay. And if you're listening to this edition for the first time on our Sunday evening rebroadcast and are just now learning that you missed what we're talking about, you can find a couple of tracks from the Senegal Project on our site, esweku.org. Lee, is this music on any streaming services yet, like Spotify, or are you still working on that?
We're still working on it. The album is pretty much finished, but the next step is to try to find a home for it. Find a label, find distribution. This kind of music is, I guess, in a way, kind of new to the U.S., but there's a strong market for it in Europe and Africa, so we'll be looking to shop the project.
Lee Carroll, artist, musician, and co-founder of Green Room Exchange. You can find it on Facebook. Thanks and good luck, Lee.
Thank you.
We have a lot in store for you on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. Tom Eblen talks with short story writer and poet Ellen Burkett Morris about her new collection, Lost Girl. And Cynthia Reeser talks with Sally Bingham about her book concerning the 1961 death at the age of 21 of her younger brother, Jonathan Worth Bingham.
My purpose in writing this story, and I'm starting on another memoir about a great loss, is to do what I can to prevent the repetition of this pattern. We lose too many young people. I've always focused on young women, but we lose more young men to these combined causes of drug use, alcoholism, depression. And I want to see if I can have any effect on the future in terms of perhaps losing fewer young men for these reasons.
In addition to Sally Bingham, we'll bring you conversation about and samplings of the traditional music of international communities in Lexington. This is music from a recent recital performed at Base 249 in downtown Lexington. Our focus next week, the Indo-American community of Lexington. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. You can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next week's edition. You can also find us on the WEKU app and on NPR One and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.